Welcome to Inspired to Heal, where I interview innovators, educators, clinicians, and leaders in government-run health institutions. Season 1 focuses on former staff at Cook County Hospital, Chicago's safety net health system. In this episode, I speak with Christine Haley, former Director of Housing for Cook County Health and current Homelessness Chief for the state of Illinois. She's joined by Keiki Hinami, the Director of Applied Research at Cook County Health. Together, Christine and Keiki worked on several initiatives to better understand and introduce solutions for people experiencing homelessness. Before starting this episode, I'd like to visit an article written by David Brooks in the New York Times, in which he speaks to a growing callousness around brutality and an ethos that is not concerned with protecting the dignity of poor people. In this article, he writes that, "I found it incredibly replenishing to be spending time around selfless, humble people who are still doing the work of serving the homeless." Christine and Keiki are two of these people. Their story starts now. How did you become interested in finding solutions for homelessness?
I think I've always had an interest in housing from when I was a little kid. My parents grew up in Peoria, Illinois. Although I was born and raised in Cook County, we'd go to Peoria every Christmas and Easter to visit my family. My dad is from a poor Black family. My mother's from an upper middle class white family. And even in ages 4, 5, 6, 7, I noticed very concretely the difference in their housing. My dad's family home was torn down during an urban renewal project in Peoria. How I understood it in the late 70s, early 80s, was that they just lived in an older house with no other houses on their block, where my white grandparents lived in a community that had plenty of housing, plenty of resources, large backyards, multi-story homes. I could sense as a kid how there was something wrong. Why was it that one of my grandparents lived in a place where their house was eventually torn down and there weren't other houses around, and for my other side of the family had abundance? This sense of not understanding why things were so different and wanting to understand what the differences were really had a profound impact on me as I grew older and understood more about race and housing and the impacts of segregation, redlining, and other systems level interventions. I felt that homelessness was very much tied to that, and I wanted to dedicate my work life to understanding how we work on systems issues while also being able to serve those who are currently in a housing crisis.
Do you know what is now in the place of the home?
Yeah. Actually, just this weekend, the Peoria Historical Society did an event that I attended. There is a large community center. There was housing that was built in some of the areas, some affordable housing projects, some public housing projects, but most of the land is empty. What was torn down was grocery stores, churches, homes, a whole community. All of those were torn down. Almost everything is gone. It's just open spaces. The vision for the urban renewal was not realized, and instead the community was torn apart. The home that my grandparents lived in, and then my great-grandparents had also lived, passed on the house to them. All of that equity was lost, in addition to the home that had been in our family for decades. What is there now is an empty lot.
That is a remarkably young age to have a career path determined. Yeah. Did you waver at all, or you went straight through high school, college, and beyond with that goal?
It very much took a while to realize that working in homelessness is where I wanted to be. But I think housing was interesting to me. I remember when I was little, my mom used to get magazines in the back. They had floor plans in it, and I would grab her magazines and go look at the floor plans. I just loved the mechanics of housing. I was also brought up in a faith tradition around service and understanding that although my father grew up in poverty, I was given a lot of opportunities in education, the phrase of who much is given, much is expected, and much was expected of me and understanding how I could be of service to my community. But I was really interested in access to housing and really in poverty. And to me, people experiencing homelessness were at the very deep end of living in poverty. My first job out of college, I was a Jesuit volunteer and worked in Northern Chile for a few years and worked with families that were unsheltered and living in a dried out riverbed and making homes out of corrugated boxes and tin. From there, moved back to Chicago and worked with families that were doubled up primarily or bouncing around from shelter to shelter. It was really at that point where I noticed that at pretty much every shelter that I went to, that almost all of the children and the families in that shelter were Black. I felt an incredible amount of both compassion for the children that were experiencing the traumas of homelessness, who would ask me and say, please, Christine, don't bring me back to shelter. Feeling both that helplessness of how is it that we allow our children to experience these traumas of moving around from place to place and that we don't invest more in an infrastructure that supports all people. Coming from a place where when I was in Chile a few years after the dictatorship, where they really didn't have the infrastructure to be able to support families who were living outside, to then moving to Chicago and being in one of the wealthiest cities in the country and one of the wealthiest countries in the world, that we also were not providing a safety net. So it was at that point that I really thought that I wanted a policy job just to work on housing policy, but over time recognized that I love this mesospace of both being and working with people and also yet working in policy. Although the one-on-one interactions are more painful for me, I have a harder time with having the right boundaries to long-term be face-to-face with folks. It's that in-between place of working in policy, working in government, but then being staying connected to the ground. Mm-hmm.
What is the path that someone would take who's inspired by hearing what you've done?
Yeah. I have a Master of Science in Social Administration. I'm an administrative social worker. I went to Case Western in Cleveland because I really loved their program. At the time, Cleveland was the poorest big city in the country, and I felt like I wanted to be in Cleveland. I worked at the Cleveland Tenants Organization. One of the things I did at the Cleveland Tenants Organization was work on lead poisoning and that connection of housing and health, and ended up working for the Cleveland Department of Public Health and led their policy work on ending lead poisoning. I wanted to get more on the housing side, so returned back to Chicago to work more directly in homeless services.
Keiki, I know yours isn't quite, didn't start at the age of 5 or 6, but what was it?
No, but Christine has a presence wherever she goes, and that history really explains the energy that she emanates. For me, it was just that the county was putting some energy into the social determinants of health around the time that you, Bill, hired me to work for Cook County Health, and health system leadership like Jay Shannon and Mary Sadak and later Letitia Reyes-Nash and others were eager to partner with you, I think, to better understand social needs in the safety net population through data and to help design thoughtful approaches to intervention. Housing was just a ubiquitous issue that emerged in every collaborative table focused on the intersection of health with criminal legal system, behavioral health, readmissions, technology implementation even, and pretty much that's how I became entangled in solution seeking with you and Christine.
I have a feeling there's more than just entanglement. What in your background made this a natural fit for you?
I also grew up in a household that cared about social justice. I grew up in a missionary school. My parents were each first generation Christians in their family and zealots around evangelism, but also in doing good work in the world. As many kids who grow up in this environment seeking purpose in life, I declared to my mother one day that maybe I too will become a missionary. But what she replied to me is what I've sort of carried all my life. She said, in congregations that she's been in, there are many people who stand up and say, support me so that I can do good work. But look at the few who actually do the work to become powerful themselves. But then when you become powerful, don't forget why you sought that power in the first place.
Interesting to hear power and your career intertwined. I never think of you as someone going for a position of power, but it is a position of influence, I guess.
That's right. I think physicians especially have so much privileges in our society. We still take it for granted that people refer to us respectfully with titles in mind. It's really in this work of working with Christine that helped me to wake up to the fact that not everybody is regarded with that kind of authority that physicians are, and just how much harder it is for not have status in society to begin to solve the intractable problems. I get to re-engage with some humility that I have so much that I take advantage of without really recognizing it.
You started really working together during COVID when there was a need to provide medical respite. What did you learn from that?
So our initial efforts to build and run a medical respite program during the public health emergency was primarily as an isolation program to slow the rate of transmission among people residing in congregate living situations like shelters. We supported individuals' primary care needs and treatment for behavioral health disorders with telehealth, prescription deliveries from methadone programs and the Provident Hospital Outpatient Pharmacy. But the key lesson, I think, from the first past experience of medical respite is the magnitude of the detriment of homelessness itself and its common correlates compared to COVID. And of course, I'm not diminishing the impact of the nearly 10,000 COVID deaths in Cook County, but I'm noting the far less alarm that we feel from the at least 10,000 substance-related deaths in our region since 2019, as well as the at least twofold greater risk of deaths from cardiovascular diseases and cancers, infections, and injuries that steadily continue to claim lives prematurely of people experiencing homelessness long after COVID has faded into the background. You know, the experience of running a shelter program gave me direct contact with how poorly people experiencing homelessness are treated in some shelters, and all of this motivated a pivot in the way medical respite programs should be designed and operate.
We were part of an early group of shelter providers, physicians, and public health practitioners that were starting to meet within the first few cases within shelter. There were a series of calls with the health department, really just trying to understand where there could be potential outbreaks, what did testing look like for the population. Eventually, as people were testing positive, there didn't exist a space for people to go for isolation. Rush created a partnership on the west side with a safe haven to create essentially a shelter for people experiencing homelessness. It was then Keiki who thought, we really need to have a space on the south side. It really was, how are we going to build the political will and build the infrastructure for us to be able to open an isolation center? We worked in partnership with the Chicago Department of Public Health, Chicago Department of Family and Support Services, and then the leadership of Cook County Health to open up a site that was in the closed Southside YMCA. It was an opportunity for us to very quickly put up a shelter. Usually you have weeks, if not months and months of preparation to open a new shelter. We had a matter of days to open. It was a lot of coordination of trying to understand transportation for people who don't have vehicles. How are we going to get people to and from the shelter site? How are we going to get meals when that was a challenge? We were there for a short period on the south side. We closed and then reopened a few months later in partnership with Housing Forward as we were able to build enough will to do this longer term. And that's how the RISE Center was created. It was really Keiki's role as a physician leader within Cook County Health to demonstrate that, yes, we could extend the work in that way.
Mm-hmm. Isolation was needed for several reasons. One being that hospitals needed to be able to discharge people to open up beds for other patients. and the number of beds for people who were experiencing homelessness had declined because shelters had either closed or weren't accepting new people. There really wasn't an outlet to decompress the hospitals. Is that fair to say is the driver for this?
That's right. There were plenty of barriers for hospitals like Strozier to discharging people experiencing homelessness from our inpatient setting or from our emergency department to even isolation programs. There were plenty of money flowing into establishing isolation programs in the city, but everybody was nervous about the ability to be the lowest barrier kind of program to accept patients. For example, patients who were experiencing homelessness but were committed to chronic intermittent dialysis. There was no program that could accept such a patient. Our goal was to be even lower in our barriers to allow as many patients to be accepted during that time. But the fact that we were able to stand up our operations so nimbly, so quickly during that time, I think was really because, Christine, your deep relationship with the agencies involved in housing people cleared the path for us to get started as soon as we did. Behind the scenes, I think there was a lot of business happening to get our leadership just in line. From within, we had, for the first time in I think, Cook County Hospital's history, we had a director of housing in you that had the skills and deep knowledge of how all of this worked. And without that, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have been able to get started the way that we did, and with the success that we've also had.
What I think the big success story is that you were able to build this quickly. And I think a lot of that might have been the distraction from some of the barriers that you would have encountered had it not been during a pandemic. But once you had it running, you were able to demonstrate how this was valuable, not just valuable for the individuals coming into the center, but valuable for the health systems. What is the RISE Center and what is unique about it?
Medical respite is a model that is utilized within the homeless field that is essentially shelter-based care for people who are exiting inpatient hospitalization with clinical supports that are provided. Because as you can imagine, it's very difficult to do that recovery if you are outside or if you are in a shelter that doesn't have a lot of supports. It really is providing that ability to recover in a safe and healthy environment. Some other medical respite programs also have a focus on housing. So once someone enters a medical respite program, how can they then transition from being homeless to being housed? Each medical respite program looks different. It is not intended for folks who need nursing home placements. It's really intended for folks who would be discharged to home if they had a home to be discharged to.
But they do have needs that aren't to the level of a nursing home, but do require some clinical oversight, like dressing changes for someone who's had surgery or burns, for example.
Exactly. There's a National Institute for Medical Respite Care that establishes standards for medical respite, provides technical assistance and training to communities around creating medical respite opportunities. When we were looking to understand how we could continue our service for being a medical respite provider, we reached out to Housing Forward, which is a homeless services agency in West Suburban Cook County. First, we were going to be in an apartment building where they had rented out multiple units. The weekend before we were to move in, the landlord pulled it and said that they didn't feel comfortable having patients that had COVID in their buildings. Mm-hmm. We had washed a lot of dishes and gotten the space ready, and then at the end of the day, the landlord said no. From there, Housing Forward regrouped all across the country. Homeless service providers were looking at how can you take empty hotels that were closed down during the pandemic and convert them into shelters. They were looking at a site that was in Oak Park, the suburban community just west of the city of Chicago, kind of a middle to upper middle class neighborhood, one of the few integrated neighborhoods in our region. They were looking at a hotel that had four floors and had a very fancy French restaurant on the first floor. We would utilize one of those floors as the medical respite floor that had 19 beds. So that is how we started.
Pivoting from the Southside Isolation Program, we recognized where the gaps in care for this population was. And largely it was the common conditions that afflicted people experiencing homelessness. We recognized that conditions like serious infections requiring home intravenous antibiotic course without a ability to get into a nursing home through insurance funding or some sort of contract funding. These were people who were essentially forfeiting their ability to receive curative treatment for a serious condition. The large number of surgical interventions that people experiencing homelessness required, either through trauma, frostbite, burns, requiring our program to provide the kind of post-procedural recovery wound care that sort of branched into pathologic wound care as well, from diabetic foot, etc. There were many other clinical pathways that we developed on top of those things, things like cancer care. Stroger Hospital is one of very few institutions that provide outpatient cancer treatment without the ability of the patients to pay. That unique practice within our public government-run health system needed a complement in the housing supports to make sure that people who were eligible for potentially curative cancer care could, in fact, tolerate the rigorous course of radiation and chemotherapy. So we open up our medical respite program to housing patients with that need as well. And there are other pathways, including hepatitis C virus treatment, similar in that the two-month antiviral course had a much higher chance of completion were the patients housed and transportation and such things provided for.
What have you learned over the past? It's almost been 5 years now. Is there a way you can, I know everyone's different, but characterize the population and maybe how it's changed your view of individuals who are experiencing homelessness?
Maybe for impact, I want to say something that I've learned more at the organizational level rather than the personal level. I think the personal level was meaningful to me, but what I want to project is to first recognize that a healthcare organization supporting a medical respite program may be the least that at least a high-functioning healthcare organization can do if they are serious about contributing to solution-seeking. It does feel to me like a low enough hanging fruit for hospitals to make contributions in the form of in-kind effort or some funding and supplies to be able to partner with agencies to open additional medical respite beds. That's one. The other is this focus on partnership, which has been Christine's modus for all the housing work that I think Cook County Health has done so far. But partnership with Housing Forward in our case, or any other community-based organization, have yielded much more benefits to Cook County Health than I imagined. Housing insecurity demands multidisciplinary solutions, and there's nothing like working shoulder to shoulder with people who are knowledgeable in this space. And I'll have to mention a few Housing Forward's people, Linda Schuler, Armando Smith, initially Holly Rutman-Zaid, who led the Medical Respite Initiative, and now Janet Hotch, who has taken over, and all of their staff to really help us in healthcare understand how this can be done at all.
Sometimes people come in, and in the environment that they are coming from, their method for interpersonal interactions can be adversarial. Living on the streets can lead to some behaviors that can be intimidating or frightening to people. You said this happens when someone comes in, there's an adjustment period.
This phenomena I witnessed directly myself, and I think I do recall mentioning it to you, Bill, is that the trauma-informed approaches to care is something that is often discussed in the caring professions, but in medical respite, it really came to life that our initial engagements with people coming off the streets into a well-appointed hotel room is initially met with surprise and joy, but often with some dysregulation in many patients' behavior, not knowing how to adjust to a completely stable and safe and supportive environment that they're just completely not used to. But Without exception, within a week or two, even the most dysregulated participant of our program always showed humanity. They became cordial, they became polite and funny and engaging. This pattern of transformation that we saw in our clients really helped me to see the deleterious impact of a hostile environment on people and how a supportive and less hostile environment could help people be who probably they want to be or who they are destined to be in their interactions with others.
I always found that the way in which Keiki would communicate with people very clearly, very respectfully, but directly was incredibly helpful in being able to de-escalate situations that could be difficult. I don't know if that's part of your training, but also just part of your temperament of being able to engage with people. And as we talked about the authority of a doctor, we also worked hard at trying to be as low barrier as we possibly could. So we invested in training how to be a more harm reduction based organization and a housing first based organization, which was hard within the homeless world. These are the values that we strive for. But what does that look like in operations? There was a lot of negotiation that we did across the partners of what it would mean for us to be in this low barrier partnership.
And there are a couple words or terms that I would want to clarify for a lot of people. One is housing first, and the other is low barrier. So these are two things that you embrace. Could you describe what is meant by both low barrier and housing first?
Sure. So housing first is both an evidence-based model and a philosophy of care. The opposite of housing first is housing ready. Being housing ready means in order for you to move into this apartment or to come into the shelter, you need to not be using substances, demonstrate that you are ready to be housed. So within a shelter context, we try to house them first before encouraging folks to understand what type of behavioral health or other supports that they might need, just as any of us need. Like, it's difficult to find a job if you're outside. It's difficult to meaningfully engage in mental health care or behavioral health care without a home. So the focus is on housing first. With low barrier, there can be multiple rules that a shelter puts in place to be able to control access to the shelter. So that includes things like no pets. It could be drug testing. It could be family composition and saying that at this shelter, we only take women and children. We don't take older boys or we don't take men. So it really is looking at what are the administrative barriers that get put in place to restrict inflow. And low barrier is really being thoughtful about what is the eligibility criteria for a housing program and then trying to remove as many of those barriers as you can.
Housing First or low barrier programs really focus on the end health outcome that is saving people's lives. A housing readiness program is not successful in achieving the ends that we're seeking because the exclusion conditions that leads to a loss of housing like substance use would be exacerbated when you are kicked out of a program. And maybe the risk of dying from an overdose would be elevated accordingly. The focus that, Christine, you placed on the RISE Center being truly a housing first, low barrier, harm reduction oriented program, I think was so important in making this a public health intervention as well as a housing intervention.
You've mentioned health systems getting involved in assisting with respite centers. The city of Chicago also has something called the flexible housing pool. Maybe you could speak to the flexible housing pool and the role of health systems in addressing homelessness.
So flexible housing pool is an innovative strategy that involves an escrow account that accepts public and private investments and subsidizes supportive housing towards goals that uphold health equity and satisfy investors' goals. In Chicago, the flexible housing pool houses several cohorts of participants, including high utilizers of crisis systems, youth and emerging adults, many with dependent minor children, the unsheltered homeless, and those transitioning from incarceration. So far, rigorous evaluation of our program demonstrates clear reductions in emergency department and inpatient utilization, improvements in health, indicated sort of tantalizingly by a signal towards mortality reduction that is yet to be confirmed in ongoing analysis.
Which data sources are you finding useful to evaluate this?
All of this is a collaborative work. Bill, your role in this podcast as an interviewer just masks the amount of work that you also put into both the medical respite work as well as the FHP evaluation. But the flexible housing pool is evaluated through a mixed methods modality. On the quantitative data side, we have been successful in aggregating data from various agencies that capture some part of the utilization experience of people who are served: Illinois Department of Public Health, Cook County Health, the region's homelessness management information system data sets, the medical examiner's death records. All of these are aggregated using a privacy-preserving record linkage technology that was developed locally to be able to create a very large data set that allowed us to rigorously evaluate the program.
When Cook County performed a randomized controlled trial looking at the costs of housing an individual versus the savings from housing them, and looked at a variety of different sources of data, hospitalizations, emergency room visits, outpatient treatment, substance use, inpatient or residential treatments, the number of days in prison or jail, and actually found a savings in cost.
A aggregate analysis in a well-conducted systematic review in utilizing data also from the Canadian experience as well as the Veterans Administration housing program. The cost savings at the healthcare institution level, I think, are significant. But at the level of the societal investment, there is some controversy there that remains. And it's one of the reasons why it's worthwhile for us to continue to evaluate the cost effectiveness of our own program locally.
One thing as we think about cost is the findings from our state's first homeless morbidity and mortality report, where they looked at what was Medicaid spending for people experiencing homelessness across the state, and found that over a five-year period, we spent $16 billion on healthcare. Our entire homeless budget for the state of Illinois for homeless housing and services is an increase of 150% from when we first started 2 years ago to now, and that entire budget is $750 million. So to think about the billions of dollars that are spent on healthcare versus what we actually spend on direct housing and services is not comparable. In the report, they found that there were 15,000 admissions for suicide attempts at the Medical Respite Center. We spent a lot of time taking care of people who were recovering from amputations from the cold, people who were becoming permanently disabled because they were unhoused. And that is just kind of unacceptable as a society that we allow that. When we talk about cost, of course, there's pieces of what we call the wrong pocket problem, where we're making investments, but are we making investments in the right place? And how can we make those shifts at a policy level?
Mm-hmm. The wrong pocket problem I was thinking of before we talked, and I thought, Do we need a bigger pocket or do we need to stitch together a lot of little pockets? And I think it's probably good to understand what is meant by the wrong pocket.
If we're spending a lot of money in trying to take care of folks that are coming to emergency rooms, that are receiving amputations and long hospital stays, if we can make a reduction by housing people, there would be savings to health systems. But does that mean that savings then goes back into the housing system that helped create these reductions? So that's where we see the wrong pocket. Where is the savings generated? And that saving that is generated, how does that get to the right system that actually has more control? And that's where we think about the social determinants of health as a mechanism to address this concept of the wrong pocket.
Yeah, right. There definitely is a subset of the population for whom a housing intervention without question yields a cost savings. The power of our evaluation strategy, at least for the flexible housing pool, is that we designed our mixed method data collection and analysis to ultimately yield a preliminary figure for the quality of life adjusted cost effectiveness of the supportive housing intervention, which, according to the standards of innovations that are paid for by society, the standard can't be that we save money on the backs of the poorest people. We have to spend an appropriate amount of our public resources to ensure that they can participate in our society. Our goal is not just to insist on cost savings, but to be able to rigorously assess the dollars that we should be willing to spend to make sure that this intervention is a entitlement, not just for the highest risk people who are chronically homeless, but for even a wider group of people who have clear ways to benefit from a few years of supportive subsidies.
Christina, what is the policy that you think would be the most impactful, or the one that you feel most invested in that you're hoping to accomplish?
Mm-hmm. What I think a lot about is about rates of Black homelessness and how to bring rates of Black homelessness down. So if you look at states that have more than a million Black residents, Illinois has the second highest disparity in the country between rates of white homelessness and rates of Black homelessness. We're the second highest behind New York State. And it's really these great migration states where we have large disparities. So it's New York, Illinois, Ohio, New Jersey, Michigan are states where rates of white homelessness and Black homelessness are so far apart. We, as the general public, really associate homelessness with bad decision making, with substance use and mental illness. And we're doing work on really trying to change that narrative and tying it much closer to issues of not having enough money on hand to be able to withstand a crisis. We worked with the University of Illinois' Institute for Research on Race and Public Policy in creating a report on Black homelessness in Illinois. We see that Illinois has relatively low rates of white homelessness. So Illinois and Mississippi have about the same rates of white homelessness. It's just our rates of Black homelessness that are disproportionate. In some of our counties, like in Lake County and DuPage County, they have the fourth and sixth highest disparities in the country. So we have significant work to do in really understanding how we are talking about homelessness as a housing issue. We've seen increases in rent amounts to up to 40% since before the pandemic. We've seen the highest number of people ever experiencing homelessness in the United States. This is a national housing shortage crisis that we have. It's something I know that, Bill, you noticed around race and people experiencing homelessness. I remember you talking about what really just feels like an economic problem. That is part of our work, is trying to make those connections so that we can drive rates of Black homelessness down.
So I'll end with the question, and maybe I'll start with Keiki. If you could put one item, literal or figurative, into your medical bag, what would it be?
I'm going to say values. A lot of what we've discussed today is about generating numbers. Let's say quality adjusted cost effectiveness for supportive stable housing intervention or for the medical respite program. In the end, I think these numbers can meaningfully update our understanding of the health and housing interventions only if we allow it to. And it's only in folks who hold certain values that updating of our thinking is possible. To state it conversely, the hearts and minds of people without these values, I think, probably can't be changed by numbers. There are several ways to articulate the values that I'm talking about, but my favorite one might be the recognition that human being is the locus of all of our values. And so to turn our backs to the suffering person is to turn away from the very value that require us to treat human beings as ends unto themselves and never as means to another end. I think the work that we've just started to do, tackling what seems to be an intractable social problem, I think is motivated, at least by me, in my intolerance of senseless suffering.
Christine, I give you a health bag or, you know, a social services bag to put something in.
If I had a health bag, I would have keys to an apartment for everyone who needed it. I just believe very deeply that housing is a human right, which means really that cost should be not the primary driver of why we should all have the ability to live in a home. Our homes protect us from the elements. They are a place where we can store our medications. Our homes provide a place for us to shower, to take care of our skin. Our homes keep us healthy. All of us should have a safe and affordable place to call home.